My name's Peter Larson, and welcome to Are Defined Benefit Funds Still Beneficial by Greg Einfeld. A quick few words on Greg. Greg has spent 20 years in financial services. For most of that time, he's worked at MLC in the areas of finance, investment, super, insurance, strategy and M&A. As the leader of MLC's insurance business, he grew market share to become the largest life company in Australia. He subsequently led the project that culminated in MLC's acquisition of Aviva Australia and then integrated the two businesses. In 2011, Greg founded Lime Super, which provides administration and independent superannuation and investment advisory services to trustees of self-managed super funds. Greg has a master's in economics and an MBA and is a fellow of the Actuaries Institute. So I'll hand over to Greg. We'll, I think, follow the usual procedure of questions at the end, and we'll get going. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Peter, for the kind introduction. So I'm often asked by people, I'm presenting, and have you got any tips for me as a presenter? And what I normally say is the chances are that you know more about your topic than the audience, so you should go okay. Well, today's a little bit different. I don't know very much about this topic at all. I'm not a defined benefit actuary, and I'm sure there are some in the room. So I know less than most of you about this topic, and I write this from the perspective of somebody who was a member of a defined benefit fund for 17 years and my experiences through the good years and the not-so-good years as a member of that fund. So in terms of what I'm going to cover off today, start off with a bit of an introduction. Like any actuarial paper or presentation, there'll be some mathematics. We'll do a case study just to demonstrate how the mathematics works. We'll talk about some qualitative issues because not everything, as you all know, is about the pure mathematics. I'll reach some conclusions and there will be some time for some questions and answers and discussion at the end because I'm apparently being gonged after 20 minutes. So we'll try and keep it brief. So what got me thinking about this topic was when my boss at my former employer, who was also an actuary, said to me, you should never, ever leave a defined benefit fund. Everybody knows that if you're a member. And I looked at my own personal situation and I thought, well, the value of my benefit in the last year has only gone up by 6%. I reckon I could have done better than that by being in an accumulation fund and just receiving the SG contribution of 9% plus earning a cash rate, less tax. I would have been better off than the result that I had in the defined benefit fund. So that got me thinking, well, there must be something more than just this blanket rule that everybody should remain in a defined benefit fund forever. Now, whenever I tell people what this paper and presentation are about, that it's about looking at defined benefit funds from a consumer perspective and should I remain in the fund or should I switch to accumulation, most people's response is, oh, your presentation's all about the solvency of funds. And here's an example of an article that appeared on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald a few weeks ago. There's been other similar articles to this one even more recently than that just last week. That's not what this presentation is about. This is purely about a mathematical outcome of how the value of defined benefit moves versus an accumulation fund. So let's get into the mathematics. So I've come up with two formulas here for how the value increases in an accumulation fund versus a defined benefit fund. And we'll start with the accumulation fund formula first. All the terms are down the bottom, but I'll explain them as we go along. So first of all, you start with a balance from the previous year. You get some investment earnings on that. And then you get a contribution, which is your salary times a contribution rate. That's a fairly straightforward formula. Hopefully that's clear to everybody that's here in the room. If we compare that to a defined benefit fund, and this second formula is an approximation, it's a very, very good approximation. So you get the benefit from the previous year, and that increases not with investment earnings, it increases with salary growth. Whatever the formula is in the fund for how salary growth is applied, whether it's the average over 3 years or whatever that might be. And then you add that to the salary multiplied, not by the contribution rate, but by the benefit multiple in that particular fund. So you can compare those two funds, those two formulas quite easily just by lining them up as I have done there. So The question then is, well, if I'm a member, which of those formulas gives me a better outcome? Clearly, if you start on the right-hand side, you compare the M, the benefit multiple, versus C, the contribution rate, less contributions tax. So typically, M is going to be higher than C. And that's perhaps why many people believe the defined benefit gives a better outcome, especially in the early years where the size of the balance is reasonably small. So you're not applying the growth rate to a very large balance. The M, which might be, say, 15%, is larger than the contributions rate, which might be 7.65 after contributions tax. But then we look at the left-hand side of the formula and you compare the investment earnings in the accumulation fund versus salary growth in the defined benefit fund. And what we see, if I look at my own personal situation, in my early years of employment, I was receiving 15% compound salary increases each year, and that was pushing my defined benefit up really well. But later on, maybe I wasn't doing such a good job. Maybe it was just a function of my skills having plateaued. Maybe it was a function of the global financial crisis. But my salary growth was a lot smaller, a lot less than investment earnings. And it got to the point as a result that the left-hand side was larger for an accumulation fund than it was in the defined benefit, to such an extent that that outweighed the defined benefit fund delivering a stronger result on the right-hand side. So I hope that makes sense, and no doubt we can discuss this further in the conversation later on. So by doing some algebra and rearranging all the different terms, I came up with what I called in the paper the comparison formula. And this is the comparison formula here, and it's not necessarily an intuitive formula, but what it says is if the terms on the left give a greater result than the terms on the right, then an accumulation fund is going to be better for this particular individual. Then what I looked at is, over time, how do each of these terms in this formula move? And we'll go through them one at a time. So we'll start off with the number of years that somebody has been in the fund, number of years of service. That has to increase over time by definition. The second one, I, investment earnings. So one might expect that the expected investment earnings should be reasonably constant. I've said, in an accumulation fund that is, I've said that as your balance grows, the fees as a percentage of your fund might decrease slightly, and also as you get to a particular age, you may be able to start a pension such as a transition to retirement pension in an accumulation fund. So the investment earnings net of tax and fees may be increasing slightly. At worst, it's steady. Salary growth, on the other hand, is decreasing. The older you get, the more experience you've got, your annual percentage salary growth is probably reducing. So you put all of that together on the left-hand side of the formula. So let's look at this. Y is increasing, I is increasing, G is reducing. The combination of those three things, the left-hand side of the formula is going to increase over time. Let's now look at the right-hand side of the formula. So we've got C, the contribution rate. Well, that's likely to increase if the government can get its proposed changes through and the SG rate increases from 9% to 12% in an accumulation fund. And M, the benefit multiple in the defined benefit fund, is steady. So we look at the right-hand side. One is constant. C is increasing. M is steady. The right-hand side is decreasing. So we've got the left-hand side increasing, the right-hand side decreasing. There will come a point in time where the left-hand side exceeds the right-hand side. The question, though, is when does that happen? So the slide I'm about to go to presents a range of options for when it happens. First, we're going to look at this with C, the contribution rate being 7.65%, which is 9% less contributions tax, and M being 15%. And we'll look at what the combination is for these other terms on the right, on the left-hand side of the equation. So we get this table here, and what this table shows is for particular rate of salary growth on the left and for particular rate of investment earnings at the top, when do you reach that point of indifference when in the next 12 months the accumulation fund and the defined benefit fund will give an equivalent result. Because once you get beyond that, the left-hand side of the previous formula is going to be greater than the right-hand side, and you'll be better off in an accumulation fund. So these numbers here in this box are the area where I think most people are at. People in their later stages of employment. Let's face it, if you're in a defined benefit fund, you've probably been there for 15, 20 or more years. So you're not going to be getting huge salary growth. And this is likely investment earnings that you might earn after tax and fees in an accumulation fund. So people making this comparison will be in this range here. And this point of indifference is happening somewhere between 10 years there and 50 years there. Although I dare say if you've been in employment 50 years, your salary growth's probably less than 4% now. So probably somewhere between about 9 and 30 years, you're going to get to this point of indifference where an accumulation fund becomes preferred for this particular member. Let's look at what happens when the SG rate goes up from 9% to 12% by 2019. Rather than the previous table, we have this one here. And my suggestion here is that by 2019, the vast, vast majority of defined benefit members are going to find that they've passed this point, and mathematically, they're better off in the future in an accumulation fund. And that's only 7 years away. Many people will already have reached this point. Of the ones that aren't there, they're going to get there within the next 7 years or sooner. So let's look at a case study. And this is the same as the case study presented in the paper. So this particular employee commenced service 20 years ago in 1992. They started off with $40,000 in salary. And the benefit formula in this fund is 15% times the number of years of service times their salary. After 1 year, they have $6,000 in their defined benefit fund. They're faced with a choice, or they were faced with a choice 19 years ago. Do I stay in the defined benefit fund? If so, they'll look 1 year forward and they'll say, in a year's time, I'm going to have 15% times 2 times 44,000, assuming a 10% salary increase back then. They'll have $13,200. Wrong button. $13,200 here if they stay in the defined benefit fund. Alternatively, if they would have switched to accumulation back then, that their $6,000 here would have grown at, say, 7%, and then they would have also earned contributions on their salary, and that would have given them $9,786. Clearly for this employee, 19 years ago, the right decision for them was to stay in the defined benefit fund, and that's what they did, so that we were able to then look at the situation after 10 years. So all the same calculations. I won't go through every single calculation one by one, but you can see here, after 10 years, still better off looking 1 year forward, staying in the defined benefit fund, because it's going to give them $209,000 versus $202,000. But we're getting to the point where there's not much in it. And you'll see here, I assume salary growth of $127,200 versus $120,000. That's 6%. So they were getting 6% salary growth at that stage of their career after 10 years of service. But now we look forward to 20 years, which is now 2012, and this member has a decision to make. Because now they have a balance of $600,000 in their defined benefit fund. And if they stay in that fund for another 12 months, they can expect, with 3% salary growth, they can expect $649,000. Alternatively, if they decide to switch to an accumulation fund, earning 7%, then they can expect to have $657,000 in a year's time. So they've now reached the point that it's actually beneficial for them, based on these assumptions, to switch across from the defined benefit fund to an accumulation fund. And the longer they wait, the wider the gap between these two numbers is going to get over time. So the case study confirms what we've come up with in the formula earlier on, and that is, in the later years of employment, it becomes more and more beneficial to switch to accumulation, and there comes a point where you reach that crossover, which this employee has now reached, and they probably did reach a few years ago as well. Of course, mathematics isn't everything. So we need to look at some qualitative issues that we can overlay on top of the mathematics. The first two of these suggest there's an even stronger case for switching to an accumulation fund. The first one here, fund solvency. So you may find yourself in a fund that doesn't have a good level of solvency, where the funding ratio is significantly less than 100%, and you might decide to get out early while you can. You may be in a situation where you have access to, say, a transition to retirement pension, and that's going to push up your after-tax earnings rate. So for that reason, it might make sense to move out a defined benefit fund so you can take advantage of that transition to retirement pension 0% tax rate on investment earnings. The rest of these issues go the other way, and people who find themselves in these situations may decide to stay in the defined benefit fund, even though the mathematics could be suggesting otherwise. So contributions, they might find that, especially if they're a high income earner, they might find that they can't receive contributions of say 9% of their salary, and that could be because they're going to exceed their contribution caps by doing so. Or perhaps because their employer is not obliged to provide contributions of 9% if their salary exceeds $175,000. Their ability to switch funds. So their employer may not allow them to actually switch funds out of the defined benefit fund. Investment risk. They might be concerned about the investment risk they take on by moving out of a defined benefit fund into an accumulation fund. Insurance. They could have access to really good insurance arrangements in the defined benefit fund that can't be replicated outside. Or alternatively, they may not be insurable outside the defined benefit fund. Defined benefit pensions, so their scheme may offer a very attractive pension, and if they're reasonably close to retirement, they might say that they're going to hang on in order to access that defined benefit pension. Benefit design, so there may be, for example, a ratchet up in the benefit multiple that once they get to a certain age or a certain number of years of service, that benefit multiple could go from, say, 15% to 20%, so that could encourage them to stay in the defined benefit fund. And lastly, optionality. And switching out of a defined benefit fund is a one-way option, as you would all know. I had a client who called me last week and said, "Greg, I switched out of a defined benefit fund 10 years ago. I'd like to go back into it. Can you tell me what I need to do?" And I explained to her half a dozen times why she wasn't able to, and she was trying to convince me otherwise. So we all know that it's a one-way street. You can't go back once you've decided to get out. Although the mathematics would suggest once you've gone out, you probably wouldn't want to go back. But nonetheless, people might want that choice. So there's a whole range of issues that should be considered in addition to the mathematics. But for somebody who isn't caught by one of those issues, I would come back to the mathematics and say the case, either now or in the next few years, is reasonably compelling that it's time to start thinking about switching out of defined benefit into accumulation. So I draw two conclusions from all of this. The first one is defined benefit funds are not what they used to be. Things are changing for all the reasons that I have outlined. And members should really start thinking carefully about whether they want to remain within their defined benefit fund or not. And that, of course, has implications for the way that trustees manage the funds and employers manage the funds as well. And the second conclusion here is this actually creates an opportunity for actuaries, and most actuaries are defining are advising the fund or the trustees or the employer as opposed to advising the members. But actuaries who are in a position to advise members, this is a great opportunity for employment for actuaries and something that I do for part of my business as well. So that ends the formal part of this presentation, and I'm now going to hand back over to Peter, who's going to facilitate the question and answer session.
Okay. All right. We've got a mic there, but I might actually walk around with it, I think. Rather than everyone have to come up.
Test that?
Yep. All right, so I'll say the usual thing, state your name, before you start your question, and hopefully we'll get a good discussion going. Does anyone want to kick off?
Yep. Colin Grenfell, working from Super Easy. Greg, I'd like to congratulate you on two things. First of all, you're one of seven actuaries that produced a paper before the forum. And that's, I believe, very beneficial. It's certainly given me the opportunity to think about the issue a bit in advance of the session. And the other thing I'd like to congratulate you on is the framework that you're putting up. It's an interesting framework of moving 1 year at a time and then looking at trends beyond the year that you examine. They're the good things. I've got a couple of problems. Could you bring up the slide that first of the mathematics slides at the start? That one. Few issues on this one. First of all, see the employer contribution rate net of contributions tax. It's also, if I've understood the mathematics correctly, net of administration charges, and it also has to be net of insurance premiums, because if you look at the first line, the accumulation benefit, I believe, in most circumstances, will accumulate net of premiums and net of administration charges. Also, the starting point for the defined benefit is your DN term. I think the starting point should be a vested benefit or a resignation benefit or an amount transfer if you're thinking of moving from a DB fund to an accumulation plan. So it should be some form of vested benefit. In other words, it's not the accumulated retirement benefit. So I think the starting point is wrong. If it's some form of vested benefit, then typically it will be discounted. So the change in the amount of discount from 1 year to another becomes an issue. Another minor technical point is that M at the bottom of the slide there threw me for a while. I just couldn't work the mathematics out, but I eventually worked out that M is actually the benefit scale. It's rather than the benefit multiple, it's what I think most actuaries would conclude to be the benefit scale, or 15% in your case study. Could I have a go at the second slide now? No, I've just about finished.
I'm glad I didn't put many slides in the presentation.
An important point is that investment earnings. In the paper, you make the comment in relation to investment earnings. This is a random variable. There is no reason why, over the long term, the expected gross earnings should change significantly. I think there are a lot of reasons why the investment earnings will change as you move from a DB environment to an accumulation environment. I did some work many years ago, but I think it would now stand, comparing the investment policies of DB funds with the investment policies of accumulation funds. And they are very different. As I think most of us in the room would expect, DB investment policies are a lot longer focused than accumulation. As a generalisation, there are of course always exceptions. So I believe that as a generalisation, the investment earnings for DB funds will exceed the investment earnings for accumulation funds. So that changes the mathematics as well. But I like the framework, it just needs a bit more work.
Okay, Colin, thank you. Thank you for your comments. Before I respond to your comments, there's one thing that I didn't point out that I should have pointed out, and that is I'd really like to thank Darren Wickham down the front for peer reviewing the paper. Sorry, Darren, I didn't say that at this particular point. The paper doesn't reflect Darren's views, it reflects my views, but Darren did review the paper and did provide me with valuable input. So, So, Colin, thanks for your comments, and in particular, thanks for your two compliments at the beginning. That was great. I really enjoyed those. Let me work through your comments one by one. So, first of all, you said the contribution rate. Let's go back here. The contribution rate C should be adjusted for insurance premiums and administration expenses. The way I treated that in my mind, and it may not have come out explicitly, I think with administration expenses, I treated that in terms of the investment earnings being net of tax and fees, as opposed to through the contribution rate. You could equally do it either way. I just chose to do it through investment earnings. Insurance premiums, yes, I agree with you. That is not explicitly allowed for in terms of the formula, and arguably it should be. I'm not sure what the best way would be to go about that. I'm sure if I put my mind to it, I could come up with a method, as could other people around the room. You net it off the C or you net it off the I. That's essentially the way to do it. That's right. So you're right. That is a good observation, and that could be picked up. Secondly, your second comment was around the starting point being the vested benefit as opposed to the benefit in this formula. And this really comes back to the point that we made down here in terms of benefit design. And I'm acknowledging the fact that there are different benefit designs out there. There are some designs where the formula that I gave earlier is the vested benefit, and there are other designs where the formula that I gave earlier is not the vested benefit and there is a discounting approach in place. And where that's the case, then the formulae that I've developed do need to be adjusted to take that into account. So I agree with your point there. I've included it here. Alternatively, further formula could be developed to take that situation into account. And this is where the advice really comes in, that it's hard to do all of this just by a simple formula, and the personal advice is necessary. Your third comment was around what I call the benefit multiple and you call the benefit scale. Yes, that is the 15%, that's what I'm referring to, and I'm sorry if I didn't use the term that's normally adopted in the industry. That's my lack of knowledge and lack of experience in this particular area, so I'm sorry about that. Your fourth comment was about investment earnings and that comparing investment earnings in an accumulation fund versus a defined benefit fund. The point that I was making here is slightly different. I'm not comparing the investment earnings in an accumulation fund to a defined benefit fund. I'm comparing the investment earnings in an accumulation fund over time. And what I'm suggesting is, in an accumulation fund, whether you've had 1 year of service, 10 years of service, or 20 years of service, the expected investment earnings prior to that year should be the same. Now, of course, it won't necessarily be the same from 1 year to the next, because there are short-term fluctuations in equity markets and interest rates and so on. But what I'm suggesting is, if I was to predict what's the average investment earnings for someone in 10 years' time versus 20 years' time, you probably couldn't say that one's going to be higher or lower than the other. Compared to salary growth, where I think we'd all agree that somebody who's 50 is going to experience lower salary growth than someone who's 25. That's the point that I was trying to make there. So hopefully I've addressed all your comments. You may not agree with them all, but hopefully that at least gets us part of the way onto the same page.
Greg, Ramani from Promontory. I think any compliments offered to the speakers must be taken with a grain of salt, because usually they are followed by fairly difficult questions. I am one of the people who also presented my paper ahead of time, and sadly, or fortunately, it was also peer-reviewed by Darren. So I'm shaking in my shoes. Coming to the main point of your presentation, I do not know how the increasingly important anti-detriment benefit will alter the pros and cons of defined benefits as opposed to accumulation, particularly as it's an increasing function. People accumulate more and more contribution taxes and impact. Two, the contributions themselves are going to go up if the government has its way. And three, as most actuaries know, almost everyone dies. Therefore, given all of these factors, how does anti-detriment, which is more easily calculated and available in DC, as opposed to DB, where the benefits might be so defined to not specifically include anti-detriment, in which case the tax office might have a legitimate point of view saying that, look, it's not part of the benefit at all, and therefore you can't pay it, and if you don't pay it, you can't claim it. Therefore, I wanted to know whether you have given any thought to the impact of anti-detriment between the benefits and costs of these two schemes.
Look, it's a great question, and I came up with a reasonably long list of other factors to take into account. You've just come up with an additional one, so you asked me if I've given any thought to it. I think you've given a lot more thought to it than what I have by the sound of it. So thank you for doing that. I'd be interested to hear whether anyone else in the audience might have some views on that as well. But certainly an important issue to add into the mix if anybody was providing personal advice to a client to consider the anti-detriment rules.
Thank you. David Knox. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate both of you. I haven't heard Romani's paper yet, but getting a paper in ahead of time is a plus. Thank you for that. I think the framework is a useful one, but can I suggest it needs to go further? And you've looked at the qualitative factors that you haven't factored into the framework. And I think the real one that will be a bit more difficult, but I think is worth looking at, and that's risk to the member. In other words, on the defined benefit side, you noted the newspaper clip, and that's a risk of solvency for a defined benefit fund. The big risk for the DC member is, of course, investment risk. And there are models around there to try and model that and allow for that volatility. And I think this paper really needs to look at that risk and put a measure on the investment risk. We learnt through the GFC that in the years just before retirement and just after retirement, a poor couple of years of return can really hurt the retirees. That doesn't happen in DB. That does happen in DC. And therefore, I think if we're talking in terms of advice to individual members, which is what really where you're coming from, we really need to factor that in somehow objectively. I think that's missing in terms of that risk measure.
David, fantastic question, and not an unanticipated question either. I think it is the biggest issue that's staring out from the paper, and so well done on picking up on that, and I agree with you. And in fact, I feel great, David, standing up here as well. I remember 20 years ago, I was the guy sitting up down there at Macquarie University, and you were the person standing up here. So in terms of that question, where I started from is, I'll come to here. At the time I wrote the paper, interest rates were a little bit higher than what they are today, or at least long-term interest rates were a little bit higher. But you could get a five-year term deposit for 6%, or maybe, in fact, 6.5% you could get at the time with a couple of banks. And then you take fees and expenses off that, and you're above this 5% mark. So you're still in this box, and your investment is guaranteed by a bank, which is then in turn guaranteed by the Australian government if it's less than $250,000. So there is essentially less risk there than being in a defined benefit fund, where ultimately it's a corporate that's backing the fund. So from that perspective, there's almost zero investment risk. But then people will always be tempted, once they're in an accumulation fund, to try and exceed a higher return than what you can get through a term deposit, and that's where risk comes into it. And so I think your question is a really good one, and something that certainly can and should be considered further.
Ashley Palmer. Thanks. Congratulations on the presentation. I think it's the initial premise, really, around whether the two options, it's really around optimising. The suggestion is, I appreciate it's in the members' interest to try and optimise, but then what value is there on certainty, the alternative of having a DB arrangement? And to hop on the back of the point that was made by the gentleman preceding was, I was just wondering, when you've in your model where you've got your investment return there, isn't that the case where it probably should be sort of a risk-adjusted earnings rate that should go in? Because then that's a fair comparison between the alternative DB with no investment risk to the member. And then that would make it far less compelling, potentially, for the switch. And I mean, I think the points on investment risk that you've mentioned and that have been mentioned are very relevant. But at the point you switch, potentially in 10 or 15 years' time, at that period you've got less propensity to take on investment risk because you're so close to retirement, as per what that gentleman said. So I just wonder if that's a potential refinement to your model.
Yeah, it is, and investment return and investment risk are clearly the key assumptions here, and that's why I've given a range. Different people will have a different tolerance for risk, and therefore different investment earnings assumptions will be relevant in different ways to different people. But the one down the end, the 5%, was intended to reflect a risk-free return or something very close to a risk-free return, net of fees and net of tax. And then for people that did want to take on a little bit more risk and therefore assume a higher earnings rate, then you could do so. That's the reason that I presented it that way. But I'm sure that those of you that specialise in defined benefit funds and in investment probably have much stronger frameworks for measuring investment risk and investment returns than what I do, because that's not what I do on a day-to-day basis. But this for me was just something that I thought was fairly simple and useful framework for doing it. But there's no doubt better ways of doing that, what I've done.
Mike Murphy from Aon Hewitt. I think the paper is very valuable in terms of that shows the style of things that need to be considered for an individual member comparison. It could also be useful from the sponsor or the trustee perspective in terms of identifying the risks to the fund in terms of its longevity and potential cash flow issues into the future. In practical terms, you did mention, the very first question, I think, identified the style of defined benefit fund where an undiscounted accrued benefit being available as your transfer value is, I would suggest, relatively rare, certainly relatively rare except at somewhat advanced ages. So if we're talking about people 55 and above, it's quite common. That would be the benefit description. In many trustees, it may not be an available benefit for transfer in any event, but I think it does point out the importance, as you've said in your paper, it is actually an individual advice area where specific detail of the very specific benefit design of the fund they're in, the insurance, the death and disablement benefits and insurance aspects of those are very important part of the comparison, and again, allowing appropriately for the costs of that in your accumulation side or the benefit value of it. Even the anti-detriment situations that was mentioned as well, it does make it actually quite a complicated exercise at an individual level based very specifically on the design of the fund. But a very enlightening paper in terms of thought-provoking as far as the sort of an area for advice for actuaries to get into in that area.
Mike, thanks for your comment. And yeah, the personal advice side is very, very important, and you do need to look at each individual because every fund is different, every individual is in a different situation. But the first part of your comment I'm just going to touch on, and that is the implications for trustees of funds. And I did touch on this in the paper as well, and I haven't done so in the presentation yet. But ultimately, if you believe the conclusions that I've drawn, and that is at some point in time, for most members of defined benefit funds, it's going to become beneficial to switch, whether that's now in 5 years, 10 years, whenever. It does have implications for the trustees of funds, especially if members behave rationally. And of course, we know that not everybody does. But if members do behave rationally, it has significant implications for trustees in terms of cash flow and liquidity and the longevity of the fund. You'll get the people that are leaving will select against the fund, and it's the people that are remaining that perhaps the ones that the fund doesn't want to be remaining. And so it does raise a whole lot of issues there for trustees to consider as well. But going any further than that is really outside the scope of the paper.
I'm Ian Bell. A little bit unique in this crowd in that I retired at 47 and I've recently been readmitted as a fellow of the Institute. Last actuarial advice I gave on defined benefit super was probably about 1978. So I've got a bit of an old perspective, if you like, and I'd like to mirror what Colin Grenfell said and in turn what David Knox said and in turn what Mike Murphy said. They've stolen most of what I wanted to say. I was very much in favour of defined benefit funds in the period that I was working with ES Knight, if anybody remembers that. That was forerunner to Mercer's. I'm still with it today. I think that it's a great shame that our system, even though Mr Keating, if he's to be given the credit for it, achieved a wonderful thing in terms of national savings, that in doing so, they didn't address the risk to immediate pre-retirees and immediate post-retirees of investment downfalls, GFCs, whatever, that can affect accumulation plans, that under the very, very useful and I think generally at the time well appreciated influence of the actuaries, defined benefit funds had achieved very useful purposes. So I think it's a great shame that we've lost that sort of ability for the public. And all you're doing is sort of pointing out that here the younger generation are wanting to take an option against these older style plans. I'm hoping that the Institute could come up with a solution that it can suggest to government to counter the balance between the disadvantages of accumulation plans, but obviously not going to go back to the defined benefit fund of old. So I'm hoping that the Institute puts some effort in that side, as Mr Knox has alluded to. But in terms of your paper, I found it very thought-provoking because I'd been thinking about it in a very old-fashioned way, and it's given a new sort of insight into some of the risks for certain types of funds. It's made me question, you know, have people been misdesigning those defined benefit funds since 1978? I don't know. I'll give you a couple of thoughts to take away, and maybe if you could think about this, that if you redid your analysis on the basis of, rather than that 15% per year for 40 years gives you six times, if we put aside the pension plans, so a lump sum of six times, if instead you look at a formula that's 9% for the first year of service, scaling up to 21%, for the last year of service, averaging 15%. On the one hand, look at that sort of formulation, and as a second variant on that, look at 9% in the first year of service being based on the actual salary in that year, and a particular figure in the last year of service being based on the actual that year. In other words, remove the simplicity of the 15% times, and remove the sort of overriding factor of the final salary, and have a look at the whole thing again.
Okay, thank you for that. That's given me some food for thought and some homework to take away, and maybe we can come back next year or in 2 years' time at the next Financial Services Forum and discuss that one, but something for me to take away. Thank you.
I was expecting the bell by now, but well, the doors aren't being thrust open, so we'll have one more.
Thanks. Tony Miller, Russell Investments. Something by way of an anecdote, but also an observation. Almost every member, unless you happen to be lucky enough to be attached to a pension plan, will at some stage convert from their defined benefit to their accumulation. So it's really just a matter of timing in some ways when you do it, and this paper helps highlight that point. One factor you might want to throw into the mix is that employers are not unaware of this aspect in some ways, that they understand the financial dynamics going on here and have lots of reasons why they may want to compulsorily convert defined benefit members to DC. When they do, the chances are they'll throw an incentive your way. So that's a reason why you might want to just hang around waiting for that incentive to come your way. It won't happen in some plans, but there are plenty of others where it may well do. I also make an historical observation that the forces you're talking about did operate inside defined benefit plans and generated many surpluses through the 80s and a little later, and many people tried to use those surpluses to enhance the defined benefits and are paying the cost right now. We know some of those schemes. But finally, an anecdote, having had 40 years of experience with various forms of superannuation funds, I was in a defined benefit fund which was largely DC, but with quite a good DB carrot once you got to age 55. So there was the opportunity to convert from DB to DC. So once at a point, we did the sums, and I cleverly worked out that I was better in DC than DB and made that conversion. So how's it all worked out? Now, 15 years later, having been through the GFC, well, for a long time I was in the money. The DC looked a lot better than the DB. My salary sort of flattened out. Thank you to all those who helped contribute to that. and markets did the right thing. So I was looking pretty good on my super there. But it's a funny thing, isn't it, financial services in the market. The GFC came along and tore the guts out of the DC, and a whole lot of work came along, and my salary went up by quite a lot. So now... and it looks like there might be more of that coming, so, the gift that keeps on giving. Right now, if I do the sums, had I stayed in that plan, and I'm now old enough to take the defined benefit, I'm better off being in the defined benefit, had I stayed there. So that curve, where will I be in 5 years' time? I can't be sure. But it is a tricky decision for people to make if you've got those options. And people need to think very hard about making that sort of call. And one observation, final observation I make, the closer you get to the finishing line of retiring, the more conservative people get, and the value of that defined benefit starts to really outweigh the thoughts of carrying the investment risk and so on. There's going to be enough of that once you retire, let alone as you get close to that key finishing line. So I think there's another dimension, and I support definitely what David was saying about the need for research in that point.
First of all, Darren Wickham, it seems I've peer-reviewed 25% of the papers at this conference, so any problems with quality, please see me. I'd like to make a bold prediction that in the 2022 Financial Services Forum, that despite Greg's paper, we'll see defined benefits as the new hot executive benefit. So there you go.
Oh. All right, well,
but just before you wrap up, and Darren, thanks again for peer reviewing. I didn't realise you had so many others to peer review as well. So I just want to come back to Tony's comment. And there's been a lot of debate recently around what's the, in an accumulation fund, what's the optimal percentage to have in shares versus bonds? And I feel what we've often seen is people go from defined benefit, which is essentially capital guaranteed, and they go completely to the other end of the spectrum where they might have a mix of 70% in growth assets and 30% in defensive assets at the stage of their lives when that's not an appropriate mix. And so for people that are making that switch, they do need to carefully consider what the right investment mix is for them. And I'm not sure, Tony, in your situation, what mix you went for when you did switch into...
Well, the wrong one
in
hindsight.
The wrong one in hindsight. But it certainly is important to... Certainly is important to get that mix right. And there's another comment I'll make which not everybody in the room may agree with, but that is that there's the alternative risk as well that if If you choose to stay in the defined benefit fund and the share markets rally or the bond markets rally or something like that over the next few years, then when you do retire and you're forced to move to accumulation, then you're actually forced to buy into, whether it's shares or whether it's bonds, you're forced to buy into investments where they may be overpriced and you've missed that opportunity to get in lower. So the risk can work in both ways, of course. Of course, I do recognise the downside risk is potentially worse than the upside. So I'm going to leave it there and hand back over to you, Peter.
Yeah, I think we'll wrap up. So thanks, Greg, for what's been a great discussion and a very thought-provoking paper. As a small token from the Institute. Thanks, Peter.